Welcome back to the special Hugo Monier podcast, which has been released this week. Hope you enjoyed the first part. Now, this week, Hugo will continue with some fabulous stories from the Lions tour to South Africa in 2009. And he'll also take us through his work with BT Sport and how difficult it was for him to begin with to be a co-commentator. But quite frankly, Hugo is now one of the best sports broadcasters out there. Plus, he wraps things up, like I said before, with his Mars 15. So do enjoy the second part of our special podcast with Hugo Monier.
I'm going to fire a lot getting tattoos in Vegas under team camaraderie, Hugo, in terms of, because I'm trying to link it. This is me trying to be professional here and link it to going on tour with the Lions, because I know Jamie Roberts was on the Looseheads podcast, Looseheads Instagram Live. On Tuesday, he talked about how much he fell in love with South Africa, and I know the tour didn't go the way you guys wanted in terms of results, but everyone who's spoken about it, has said it was such a good tour in terms of that team bonding element.
Yeah, it was. You know, when I say it's the best tour I've ever been on, especially from a live perspective, it's the only live tour I went on. But you speak to the true legends of this game, like your Paul O'Connells, your O'Driscolls, your O'Garas. And they're like, that's the best live tour I've ever done, hands down. And it was the last one before the invasion of the camera phone. Like, we straddled two spheres. We had most definitely had like one toe / foot in the amateur era plus one massive foot in the professional. Like, we worked really hard. You've got to, like, come on. But that goes without saying. But we made sure that we enjoyed ourselves as well. Like, I'm a firm believer. I'll learn more about somebody in the pub in half an hour than I would a season in the gym. Yeah. It's the point where you open up, you have those conversations, you develop those bonds, and you work hard. And we loved it. I remember we turned up, what game was it? It must have been, I think we're still playing our warm-up matches, but we must have played a midweek warm-up match. I think we just arrived in Durban. And we said, we're all going out. And everyone got on a team bus, like a 50-seater team bus, emblazoned in Lions. It was the most inconspicuous team bus ever. Like, everyone knew what it was. We parked up outside the entrance of the nightclub and we all walked in. Imagine that happening today. It'd be front page. Like, it was ridiculous. I had a funny story, actually, because we got security brief before we went to South Africa. Like, you've got to be careful of this and go out in numbers and be careful after dark and all that kind of stuff, and rightly so. Beautiful country, but every country has its dangers. Went into his nightclub, and there was this like mezzanine level where a few of us having some drinks and was like spying on the lads, seeing what lads were getting up to on the dance floor. And I saw a couple of familiar faces who were looking quite active on the dance floor. And I got myself with these laser pens, so I like put a dot on one of the lads' heads, like just saying, I can see you. Next thing you know, bang. They're getting rugby tackled. I was like, what the heck has just happened here? And this is the first point on tour where I knew we had two undercover security guards with us. We've been on tour about 4 weeks. They were stealth. This guy gets up and I'm like, mate, what's happened here? Like, and he said, I just said, mate, I'm just trying to see my mates on the dance floor. But of course, like a laser on someone's forehead in South Africa often means something totally different. I just had this laser pen, which was good for nothing at that time. So I got a stark warning as to, I threw that away. I ended up finishing my night, but it was a brilliant tour. We did all kinds of amazing trips. I remember we went to a township. We went to a township one day. We finished training. Training went on really late. Meant to go to a township. It was meant to take 45 minutes to get there. But because training went on so late, we ended up being in rush hour. So someone managed to get us a helicopter because we couldn't miss this thing. There was about 800 kids waiting for us. We were to open this school pitch. Sean Edwards, myself, Brian O'Driscoll, and maybe Rob Carney was on this helicopter. So we did it. We got there in like 10 minutes. It was amazing that we were able to be there as at the time we were meant to be there. But like, it's the worst PR disaster ever. We land and then tried to say, I totally understand your struggles, the pain. Like some of these kids that have shoes, some of them got one meal a day, and there's us like, we get it, we get it. Anyway, cheerio, we've got to get on this helicopter because we've got dinner waiting for us. Like, that was an amazing day. The way in which it happened perhaps could have been managed slightly better, but it was just an unbelievable tour. Like, lifelong friends, lifelong memories.
I was sort of hoping you're going to say, Hugo, that the guy that tackled you in the nightclub was Sean Edwards.
It wasn't, but I've got loads of stories. I've got loads of stories on Sean. Loads of stories with Sean. I'm not sure he thanked me for any of them, so perhaps we'll save it for a loose head podcast after dark or something one night.
Can I just ask you, Hugo? I'm a bit of a Lions freak. I just think the whole concept's brilliant. It as you just said, you've got 1 foot in a professional era, 1 foot in the amateur area, and I think the Lions thing just transcends all that. It always will be like that, I hope. Yeah. And but just when you walk in and you've got these characters that, you know, they select them like, it's like going to Hogwarts, it seems to me. It's the rugby equivalent of Hogwarts. And when you get your jersey, it's the pinnacle, isn't it? It's got to be the pinnacle. How did you feel becoming a Lion?
Wow, that's a big question, isn't it? The team announcement day itself was a stressful day because you heard of stories of previous tours where they'd got letters or phone calls. And that didn't happen, so I didn't think I was selected. I knew I was in the running. Graham Rowntree called me about a month before, said, mate, you're very much in the frame. Just make sure the next 4 weeks, the best four matches that you play. And I was playing well at the time, I was confident, but you just never know because the Lions is this unicorn which you forever chase. It's remarkable. It's the most exclusive rugby club in the history of rugby. So the team announcement day, I remember we had a team meeting at Harlequins and they announced it live in Scarlet at 1:30. So we came out of the team meeting, went into our games room, TV was on, and they went from fullback down. So I didn't have to wait that long, mentioned the fullbacks and they said my name. And a few lads like jumped for joy and was really chuffed. I think I did a quick fist pump, but at the same time, I was respectful and understanding that there was, I think, three or four other guys that were hoping to be selected. And I was the only one for Quins to be selected. So it was amazing, but you've got to feel for your teammates as well, because I'd have loved to have toured with some of my teammates from Quins. But then you're back to reality because we had to go out and train. So went out and trained, came back to my phone, genuine. Never had so many texts, missed calls. I had about 300-400 text messages, hundreds of missed calls. I just got in the car, rang my mum. She was screaming down the phone. And I tried to text some other people, not whilst I was driving. And then went back to my house and I just turned my phone off and just went to sleep. I genuinely was emotionally exhausted. I was flat out. It's just like, boom, just want to sleep. And that's what I did. So there was no big celebration, nothing like that. But then going into camp and you're like surrounded by, I believe I was part of the last tour of the last set of legends that we had in the game. And I've now mentioned a few of those. And I think from 2013 onwards is the new generation of legends. So I was thrilled to work and be a part and call guys teammates who I felt were legends. And for me, I went on the tour to be a test Lion, to do myself proud, do country proud, but also to learn. Like, what a great opportunity. I've only had six caps before that moment, so I just wanted to learn. But then getting the test jersey, the night before the first test, we had our ceremony and handed out the jersey. It wasn't anything grand like anyone thinks, because once again, you're in that situation where there's a lot of disappointed people. So the geeker just hands out your jersey. There's a ripple of applause right at the end, and that's that. You shake the hands of the people in your position that weren't selected. As Shane Williams wasn't selected, he was World Player of the Year. And he was absolutely brilliant with me, as was Luke Fitzgerald. And I wrote to Jamie Roberts before the first test. And then we had to do a little player diary. And I said it on Instagram Live, but we both said, like, if tomorrow's the last game of rugby we ever play, then I'm okay with that, because we've got to wear the British and Irish Lions jersey, and that's how it felt. Yeah. And it was almost the last time I ever wore it after the first test. So I was glad to get another option or opportunity in that third test, and you know, that felt like real redemption. That was that day, 4th of July 2009, third test match at Ellis Park. Yeah. Just blew me away.
Geach was right, I think, even at the level we've all played at, but in 30 years, all you'll need is a look. I guess with the Lion, yeah, it's all you'll need.
100%. There's guys who I'll infrequently see, but as part of that tour, which... He's right. You just need a look. It's just there. It's unwritten. It's unspoken. But I think when you're a part of a team and a very special team, and you've done everything you can to be part of that team, and then you've put absolutely everything into those 7 weeks away from your friends and family to achieve a common goal, like, of course you're set for life. And so that's why it's so unique as a challenge. That's why that shirt is so, so special. And quite clearly, one of the best, if not the best, rugby moment of my life. But the tour, everything surrounding it, being part of it, is just phenomenal.
Because I was going to mention sort of the third test, Hugo. I mean, you just touched on the third test there. I don't think we need to go back to that. But the third test with the intercept and sort of there's quite an iconic picture, I think, of you celebrating. You can see sort of the passion, the emotion on your face when you do celebrate. Was that just everything that you've spoken about culminating into one special moment for you?
Yeah, it's weird. I'd watch it for the first time a few weeks ago when Sky replayed it, and it felt weird watching it. It was on TV, and my missus was there. She's not really bothered about rugby, but I was like, she was like, is that you playing? I was like, yeah, that's me. And I remember my first comment was, wow, like that stadium looks insane. It was weird thinking that I played on that arena. I played in a stadium as big. Like it was nuts because I'm now just a fan of the game, right? And I've removed myself or dislocated myself the memories or the kind of perhaps the emotional feeling of being a player. So when I now look back on games of myself, I'm that fan watching a player that was me once upon a time. And it's quite nice to always be that child again and just be that fan. But yeah, that moment was insane because we're under loads of pressure. It was so important we got something out of that tour. We felt we deserved more. And like I said, like for me, redemption, it really felt like that. I needed that moment. And to score that intercept, score the try. And if you've ever been to Africa, or if you haven't been, go. As a fan, as a player, it's a remarkable place for rugby. It's rugby on a different level. It means something very different to them than it does to us. And that was shown in the Rugby World Cup final, actually, in terms of motivation. But to look around the stadium, and it was a sea of red, genuinely sea of red. They were outnumbered massively. Because in all the pictures, and I know the picture you talk about, majority of fans you can see are Lions fans.
Yeah.
And if I could have, I would have broken down and cried in that moment because it was just like, it's too much. You just scored for the Lions. You're doing it at Ellis Park. You've got tens of thousands of fans just there. And that, actually, the most special moment was, and for me, what typifies the Lions was that you had Stephen Jones come over, Rob Carney, Tommy Bow, Ricky Flutie. So almost the representation of all the other nations come down. And then Stephen Jones, Rob Carney, Tommy Bow leave. And I've watched that footage. Ricky Flutie wouldn't let me go. Just wouldn't let me go. And it's just so nice. He was just so happy for me, as I was for Shane Williams, who played in his last ever Lions match and didn't get to play in the first two. I was so happy for him when he scored. And it's your personal and individual agendas and goals go out the window because it's all about doing what's good for the team. And so that moment, that try will forever live with me. So special.
Yeah, and it's such a special moment in your career, Hugo. And obviously, you spent 13 brilliant years at Harlequins, and you were a one club man. And you mentioned before that, you know, you were tempted to leave in the early days, but when you did sort of hang up the boots for the final time, how special was it for you to realise how much you contributed to Harlequins? Because I know you did a really good piece on BT Sport recently with Chris Robshaw and talking about his career, and I guess you can take a lot of reflection on the same things he was talking about as well.
I've not really reflected on my Quinn's career all that much. I don't know, like, I'm aware of the numbers. I know I played 241 times, scored 89 tries. I know what trophies I've won, but to sit down and just immerse yourself in your thoughts and congratulate yourself that's perhaps something that I'll do when my kids are old enough and DVDs of the VHS of this era and whack them on and just watch a few tapes, and hopefully she thinks Daddy was once upon a time like quite cool. But I loved my time at Quinn's. It's why I stayed so long. And like, thank you for having me for so long, Quinn's. But I had some unbelievable moments, had some really special moments, had some bumpy times as well. But yeah, it's a place which I still love, but you move on. It's like anything, like to almost quote Chris Martin and Gwyneth Paltrow, we unconsciously uncoupled unconsciously uncoupled a number of years ago, and you don't want to cling on to the past all too much because you want to look forward, and I'm really excited about things I'm doing now and the things that I can achieve going forward. And you know, I think retirement feels quite final, but I knew that I would hopefully achieve more when I retired than when I actually played. And since then, I got married, had two kids, entered a new career which I love. So I love my time at Quinn's, you know, right from the age of 18, being this skinny little runt who was quite fast and had good natural ability to the guy who was clinging on at the end. It was an amazing journey, remarkable. And I'm still very good friends with lots of the players and lots of the staff. It's weird going back now, really weird going back now, because it's like seeing an ex-girlfriend, but you're on really good terms with, like, you know, like, it's a place that used to work, got great moments, but just can't have it anymore. Not saying I want my ex-missus, and my missus may or may not listen to this podcast, but just to make that very clear. But yeah, I've just got really fond memories.
And to kind of throw in into your playing career, before we go on to the media side of things, Hugo, you did obviously represent the Barbars as well. And he said on the Instagram Live that it was the best week of your career, if that's the exact direct quote. I'm not sure if it is. But what makes that Barbars experience so special?
It takes you back to the very essence and the reason why you wanted to play rugby in the first place. To be with your mates and to have fun. And the Barbars do that to quite a decent level, I think. You rock up, you get given your stash, and I don't care how old you are, everyone gets excited by stash. And once again, it's another iconic shirt. Everyone knows about the players that have worn that shirt, played for that club. And to do it just as I'd announced my retirement, and it was the second time the second tour I'd been on with the Barbers. I think I toured back in 2004 maybe, or 2006, something like that. But I never played with George Smith, funnily enough. Did play with him at club level, 111 caps. Unbelievable player, but what a legend of a bloke. Joe Rocathoco, I grew up watching him. He's now my teammate. It's nuts. Like, you can still be a fan, do you know what I mean? You can still get excited about some of the names that clubs sign or who then become your teammates. And we had so much fun. We went out, so we started in London. I took the boys out Saturday night, Sunday night, and then we flew to Belfast, I think. Arrived at the airport, the boys are drinking. I was like, oh my gosh, wow. Here we go. Don't want to be a bad lad, do you? So we're having a few beers. We had quite a good day that day. I think we played golf. the Tuesday we woke up, we had some training, we had a bit of a break in the afternoon. I remember speaking to George Smith because I was battling, I'm not struggling now, like, to go again. I was like, George, are the lads going out tonight? And he's like, yeah. I was like, oh, yeah, yeah, just making sure we're all up for it. So we had a lot of fun off the pitch. And then to play my last game against England at Twickenham was a wonderful day. Obviously not the right result we wanted for the Barbarians, but if you've not done it, any professional rugby players are watching this, please, if you get the invitation, I mean, you'd be stupid to say no. It's genuinely one of the most fun and best weeks you'll ever have in your career. As a professional, you go week to week, pressure, analysis, a little bit of fun. The emphasis with the Bar Bars is about having fun, because as much as I spoke about the lines and the challenges it's got, you've got 7 days to bring these nomads and make them look something like a team, put on the jersey and do it justice. So, brilliant experience.
I'd love to be a fly on the wall on one of those nights out with the Bar Bars.
Yeah, you'd write a good book. You'd be able to write a good book. That's for sure.
And if you don't mind, Hugo, going on to kind of your work now, and Mark mentioned yesterday that kind of we were looking in terms of how you made that transition from playing rugby into the media. And I guess he mentioned sort of Alistair Eakin being quite an influence on you probably getting yourselves into the media role. I mean, how was that transition for you? Because you talked before about players who finish the careers and I'm not sure what they're doing, but media seem to fall right at your feet straight away.
Yeah, I more stumbled into it than planned for it. I signed my last contract at age 28, so I had 3 years. And I said to myself, if at the end of those 3 years my body feels great and I still want to play rugby and I think I can play high-level rugby, then I'm going to continue to do it. But if I can't, I want to look at what else I can do. So I looked at loads of things. And I'd always been interested in media. And Ali's a great friend of mine, but it was actually Nick Mullins that helped assist me, or at least plant the seeds. He messaged me because I'd done a couple of bits of BT, and he said, would you mind going for coffee? So we met Cafe Nero on the London Road in Twickenham, sat down. And he said, what are you planning to do when you retire? I said, I'm not sure. Got some options to stay at Quinn's, to move elsewhere in the Premiership, and to move to France. What do you think about that? And he said, you could. How long do you reckon you could play for? I said, I honestly reckon I could play high-level rugby for another 2 years. But he said, if you have a career in the media, I think it's going to outlast your rugby career. Have a think about it. See if you fancy it. I reckon you might be quite good at it. So that came into my last year of my contract, and I signed for 25 days with BT. And the first thing I wanted to know was, would I enjoy it? Would I enjoy it? Because I spent 14 years loving this career. So it's really important, whatever I went into, I loved. And the team at BT, and I'm not just saying this, and of course everyone expect me to say it, they're brilliant. We really get on well. And I think it's actually our biggest strength is how well we get on. And I loved it. I really enjoyed it. I've always liked my analysis. And it felt like the next best thing that I could do after playing rugby. And so that's kind of how I got into it. And my first job from retiring was working on the World Cup for ITV. So it was like quite a big job. And I was really excited until we played Australia, got bombed out. And all of a sudden, you start to understand how the media works, because everything is all about talking about tries and hyperbole and bigging up players, but there are the moments where you are really compromised. So having a microphone under your chin and you've got 1 minute to answer a question as to whether I think Stuart Lancaster, who's my former England coach, should be sacked, and whether one of my best mates, Chris Robshaw, should have the England captaincy taken away from him, and it's the first job you're doing, you understand that you've got respect the trade and the industry. So it was a baptism of fire, but I absolutely love what I do. I really do.
Because I was going to mention that kind of learning curve, Hugo, because I guess when you are in co-coms and you do see things like the 2015 World Cup, or maybe if it's in the Premiership now, where if Danny Kerr scores a winner at Sandy Park or King's Home, for example, and you do have those connections with those guys, but you've probably now learned, and you definitely have learned, sort of the balance between passion and emotions for your, for, the, for your friends, but also delivering the analysis that the fans and the rugby public want to hear.
Yeah, the first year I found it hard. I was too close to the game, too emotionally invested. I hadn't been out of the game long enough. And so I always felt slightly compromised. But now I'm actually not that bothered. Like, if Danny's been crap, I'll say he's been crap because it's my job too. And I'm not being funny. His friendship don't pay my mortgage like BT do. So I've got a job to do. Like, when I'm in commentary and I've got a microphone in my hand, you're paid to do your job. You know, I can't go to the TMO. If someone asks my opinion, I can't go, can I refer that one? Do you know what I mean? So it's literally what you're paid to do is to give an opinion. So at least I've thought about it. So I'm not fussed about that. I used to get bothered because I was guaranteed every single week a player will text me, why didn't you give me man of the match? Why did you say this? Why did you say that? It happens every single week. But and I'm happy to explain as to why, and you've got a job to do. The beautiful thing is, or the interesting thing is that every week someone calls me biased. So now I've been biased for every single team in the Premiership, which by definition makes you unbiased. But that's absolutely fine. But I totally understand as to why some people get frustrated, because the one thing I've learned is, I think as a commentator, especially when you want to talk positively about the game, you become a glory supporter. I want to talk about the best things that happened in the game and the team that dominated. Because if I just pointed out every weakness and every frailty in defence or attack, I'm going to sound like a whinger. Instead, I'll talk about the team that are positive. So you do then end up becoming that glory supporter. And we talk about the perfect game, because we talk about, why did he make that pass? Why? Oh, how's he missed that? How's he not seen that? Why did he drop that? Why did he miss that tackle? So we talk about the perfect game. And part of that is to educate people as to why things happen and how rugby should look. That's not to say that I've never made those mistakes, but we have a duty to not only talk about the game analytically and be strong to give an opinion, but also to educate people at home, because rugby is the second most technical sport in the world. And some of the laws are so backwards. So if I do a Six Nations game, we go back two seasons to England-Ireland, and I've got to explain to someone in 10 seconds how Henry Slade can pass the ball forward 3 metres, but it's not deemed a forward pass, and it's play on the Johnny Maker goal to score a try. That's the level which we have to deal with.
When you were sort of starting out, Ugo, I mean, you mentioned kind of the guys that you worked with before, like Nick Mullins and Ali, and obviously with Craig and Sarah as well. Did you sort of look for them for tips and hints, or was it kind of you learning a job as you go and thinking, actually, no, I'll use that next time and that kind of thing?
No, I was on the phone all the time to my boss, to Craig, to Nick, to Ali, and to another guy called Rob Nothman, because as much as I enjoyed analysis and critiquing my own performances when I played rugby, I'm not, even now, I've only been in the game 5 years, I still don't have that critical analysis over what a brilliant performance looks like. Ali, Nick, I've worked with Miles Harrison, they've been in this game decades. And so I want them to tell me what I've done okay and what, where I've been really crap. And I don't mind it. The one thing I yearn for is feedback. And there's no point in me getting on the phone for someone to say, oh, Hugo, you're brilliant. You're brilliant. But 3 years later, you don't get your contract renewed. Why? Well, you've actually been crap the last 3 years. We just haven't had the bottle to tell you. I need you to tell me now. That's the only way I'm going to get better. And fair play to those guys. They're amazing. They're absolutely brilliant. So I'm forever learning. I'm forever having sessions, watching other people and trying to pick up tips of how they do it really well. Because I look up to those guys because I think they're masters of their art.
Absolutely, Hugo. And I think maybe possibly one of the greatest bits of broadcasting you've done was actually that drop goal at the London Stadium. That went viral.
Such a funny day. And that was really Craig Dawn. We had Emily Scarrett as our guest, and she was talking about how playing at a football stadium as a kicker can be quite tricky because you don't have the same point references on the side of the pitch and everything else like that. I said, Craig, I'll tell you what, Emily, I'm going to ask you this question, chuck us the ball, and I'm just going to try a drop goal. Never kicked one in my life, ever, before. And I didn't really care about the outcome, because if I spanned it and it went 50 yards left, it just would have been funny. Had I fallen over, it's funny. But to hit it as sweet as I did, and it to bisect the poles in the manner which it did, I think Joe Marlon looked over to what the heck just happened. It was, I don't know where that come from, but yeah, it was, yeah, it's probably the best bit, probably the best bit of work I've ever done for BT.
Play it so cool as well afterwards.
My drop.
Well, what you didn't see was obviously we went straight to break, but the pure panic that I dropped like a £3,000 microphone just to be cool on camera. So it was a case of have I actually broken this expensive bit of kit? But fortunately enough, it didn't. My boss was actually in the production truck, and I rang him straight after, said, "Mark, going home. Whatever I say in commentary is never going to top that. So can I just go home now and just have a lie down and watch a game from home?" He obviously said no. I went up into commentary, probably fluffed my lines, but there we are.
And just finally, Hugo, in terms of sort of the media side of things, I mean, it might be quite a tough one for you, but what's kind of the best game or the best moment you've commentated on? Because I guess when the game's flowing, there's a real tempo and there's that energy in the stadium, you as commentators and Nick and Austin or Ben, who's working alongside, you must all feel that energy.
Yeah, I love it. There's nothing. I remember doing semi-final of the Premiership. I forgot what year it was. But when Exeter or Henry Slade kicked the ball into the corner with about 30 seconds to go, and then Exeter Chiefs set up their infamous driving maul and scored in the corner. Because 2 minutes previous, I think Mike Ellery scored in the corner. We're like, well, that's the game. That's the game. In sport, you can't beat a last-minute winner. Think of Martin Tyler, commentary, and the Aguero moment. You just can't beat it. So that was one of the most fascinating moments and one of the best moments to be in commentary. And actually, those moments actually require very little commentary. And I learned a harsh lesson from Nick Mullins. I commentated at Toulon, and I think they played against Wasps or someone. It was in the Heineken Cup a few years ago. And another incredible moment from one of their Galacticos scored another brilliant try. I've forgotten who it was and what the moment was. And I got so excited. The try was scored. And I just started talking. I was like, wow, what a moment that was. And then in the bar afterwards, Nick Mullins said to me, or straight after, maybe at halftime, he said, if what you've got to say is better and more impactful than 25,000 screaming fans, then go ahead and say it. And sometimes the best bits of commentary is actually just being totally silent and just allowing the pitchers to do all the work. And funny enough, I actually went back and watched that Aguero goal just to pick up commentary tips. And if you ever get a chance to listen to it and watch it, do. Because he obviously says Aguero and then he's silent for 10 seconds. Because what can Martin Tyler say? What can he say or do that can depict a better picture than what you're watching? Because it's all about the atmosphere. It's about the Man City fans going nuts. It's about the flags. It's about the fact they've just won the Premier League. So the best moments are actually ones where you're silent. So you're not paid to be silent, of course, but it's picking and choosing those moments. But if I don't mind just adding to that, the best game I've ever been to, and unfortunately I wasn't working, was Scotland-Japan at the World Cup. Yeah. Historic day. Obviously Japan went on to win and managed to get into their first ever quarter-final. But I remember leaving the stadium. And this is where you go to certain countries and you learn lessons. And not just rugby lessons, but like life lessons and social lessons. As I was like leaving the stadium, and let's not forget, this was 24 hours after a super typhoon, the biggest typhoon they've seen in a quarter of a century. Historic moment for their nation, where their king or prime minister or whatever, someone from their biggest office in the country sat there, and they've got to their first ever World Cup quarterfinal. as we were leaving, and there's jubilation and tears in equal measure, I saw there was queues of people, and I thought, wow, the bar's really busy, but they're not a massive drinking nation. And it was all the Japanese people queuing up to take their empty drinks, cups, bottles, and everything else, and there was queuing up at recycling points to put it in the bin. And I just thought, like, that's just remarkable. That's obviously remarkable of what I've seen on the pitch. And I'm not trying to overstate it, because our behaviours, the way in which we act, we've all done it. Like, I've done it shamelessly. Football, rugby, bought a burger, leave it on the floor. For them, it's just not acceptable. But their pride, or the pride which they take in their country, in every meaning of that word, is just remarkable. How can you behave in such a way which we would almost consider abnormal in such an emotional moment, but yet still have the mental capacity to understand and know to do exactly what's right? I just love that.
Yeah, it's great to hear you talk, Hugo, about sort of the commentators letting the pictures paint the picture, if you like, because at BT Sport, they do it so well with football. I mean, me, Mark, Dave and Robert are Liverpool fans, and, you know, you see You'll Never Walk Alone, and they let that play. And it just, and I mean, I think, I'm not sure this is right, but we had a chat yesterday. Were you at the Barcelona game with Danny, or were you at another game with Danny?
I took Eddie Jones to it. So
right, that was it.
I was out in Japan with Eddie. We did some filming together, and we had a couple of beers one night, and we'll just talk about sports. I know he's a big football fan, and he says he like really intrigued by Jurgen Klopp. And I went, right, I'll take you to a Liverpool match when we go. Fine, okay, sweet. Ring BT. I was like, quarterfinals, or what was it? The quarterfinals, Barcelona.
Semi-final, Barcelona.
Semi-finals. So I'd been to, in fact, I'd been to, because they played Roma earlier on.
The year before.
Or was that the year before? So I'd been to that, and I'm an Arsenal fan, but I'm in love with Anfield. So I went to Roma, and that was just a remarkable day. So when I spoke to BT and said, can you get me a couple of tickets to Barcelona match? I'd like to invite Eddie Jones. So I went there, took Eddie up, sat in the stands, and we had a lovely dinner beforehand. He's now sat in the stands, and you can see there's a few people around, like, just double take him. Just like, he's a big dog, right? And these people know Eddie Jones is. But anyway, everyone's really calm. Next thing you know, it's 3-3, and the bloke next to Eddie is picked him up and like jumping up and down, like hugging him. And he's like, now he's talking to Eddie Jones, and he's having the time of his life. And then obviously they go on and they win the match. And you're just like, this is it. But people in the crowd are just getting a bit rowdy. So I was like, Eddie, let's get you back into the box, take you out of harm's way, just sit down, let's just have a beer, just cool off. So I take Eddie into the box, and we all just sat there. And in fact, during the game, I said to Eddie, if we could develop, when I say we, not me, but if we, rugby, could create an atmosphere like Anfield, England would never lose at home. They would never lose at home, 100%. So we'll just talk about all these things and how much he loves football. We had such a good conversation. We continued it in the box, and I just popped my head out because I could still see people. They were chanting and singing. And actually, the other thing I said, I wish the people that were at, all the staff at rugby, actually were massive rugby fans. Because after that game, the stewards, the hostesses, the waiters, the waitresses were all crying their eyes out. It just means more. It just means more. How can we get that in rugby? So I went back out, and the hostess and the security staff all cried their eyes out. And that was the moment where they all singing You Never Walk Alone to the cop. And so, as much as I was trying to do a good thing by Eddie Jones, he was sat in the box. I was out there with my camera phone just watching this historic moment. Came back in. I was like, guys, you'll never guess what you just missed. What is it? I was like, oh, no, it's fine. I got it on my phone. Got on my phone. Why didn't you call us like 3 minutes ago whilst I was singing it to the cop end? But yeah, it was amazing to be able to take it. And actually to hear from Eddie, who said that was the best sporting event he's ever been to in his whole life. He's been in 2 World Cup finals. 3, sorry. He's won one. you know, he's been around rugby for a long, long time. He's done some pretty special things, but it just goes to show what a special place Anfield is.
Absolutely. I think we can all echo that, can't we, guys?
Yeah, indeed.
Oh, yeah. Brilliant to hear your memories and your stories, Hugo. But I think now it's time for the most important part of this podcast, and it is your 15 to take on the Martians on Mars. So, Mark, over to you.
Just before we get into it, my best mate and I, who Barrel, who we played together for 1,000 years, and we have a phrase that we only have for each other, which is something happens and it obeys every single law of rugby. We just call it rugbiness. And I think we've just had an hour and a half of utter, unashamed rugbiness from Mr. Rugbiness. So this I love the Lions chat. I love the Barbarians chat. I love the fact that players can be as professional off the scale as they can be. But we should never lose sight, and I hope it never loses, the reality of why whatever brought us down to the rugby club age 7, 8, 9, 10, kicking and screaming, and that odd transition we go through to we need it more than it needs us for a while.
Yeah.
And then when we retire, we look back, and this whole Mars 15, we can all pick our best 15, and that's great, but it's not based on sheer talent. You talked earlier about hard work will almost get you in the changing room. Talent will get you in the changing room, but hard work will keep you there. And I think this Mars 15 captures something else. But the basic principle is this, Hugo. And you've got 1,000 stories, which I could listen to forever. Mars have landed on Earth. They've challenged us to a game of rugby to settle the age-old score of who owns Earth. The winner saves civilization. The shuttle leaves tomorrow. That's Saturday. It's 4 weeks to get to Mars. We've got to pick a 15 to take the field. You're only allowed 3 subs, and then you're allowed to take a water boy and a kit man, a manager and a coach. And I think Hugo Monya's Mars 15 will be something to behold.
I hope so. I've made this one slightly bespoke. I've made this Mars 15 out of players that I've played with. Because I didn't want to go cliche. Jonah Lomu, you know, of course, he was one of my idols. So I looked up to him and absolutely adored him. He was rugby's first ever superstar. I'm fortunate enough to meet him once. So I just wanted to make it a bit more personal, because you can just pick anyone and everyone and live in that fantasy. And I guess this is a game that will almost definitely not happen. But if it was, I would like to select some players that I know that I've gone to battle with. But just quickly, on your point about losing that rugby essence and how it can slightly get distorted when you go through the different age grades and all the rest of it. But during this pandemic, people have really understood what health is for health's sake. I think you get to any bit of like sunny weather, you get through Easter, and people start to try and get fit. Let's get fit for Marbella or Beach Body Ready. And you see all these slogans, Instagram influencers which wind me up. People have tried to get healthy because they know it's good to be healthy, period. So people have now got into a good routine, a pattern of whether it's going for a walk, taking the dog out, going for a run, 5K challenge, 3K challenge, whatever it is. And as much as we're all desperate to see the professional game back on our screens and supporters back in stands, I do help that people's awareness to how good it is to be healthy means that we get a greater footfall into grassroots clubs. If you have been going out for weekly jogs, twice weekly jogs, whatever it is, get down to your local rugby club. If you're a fan of rugby, it's never too late. Just get down there and just get yourself hardwired back into what it is to be a team. Because anyone that's ever picked up a rugby ball, anyone that's been in around a rugby environment, knows exactly how special it is. So I do hope that some of the behaviours and habits that people have picked up means that we do see an uplift at the grassroots game and in the local game as well.
Hear, absolutely.
Okay, so my 15, comprising of people that I've been fortunate enough to play with. At Loosehead, I've got Jason Leonard. I mean, fairly self-explanatory. The fun bus, a long tour. I just think it'd be unbelievable value, right? At Hooker, Keith Wood. One, because he's just a legendary player, but also the impact he had on my career, and I'll forever tell it, was just phenomenal. I joined Harlequin in 2001. He was the world's best player, and he was injured. I was injured, and he took me under his wing, a hooker and a winger, training together for 6 months. He didn't have to do it, but he had every ounce of humility and every moment of the day just to sit down and talk to me and help me, guide me, and talk to me about what work ethic was. He is an utter legend. So Keith Wood, straight in at hooker. At tight end, Phil Vickery. Yeah. Not just because he's a brilliant rugby player and a top bloke, but if we need someone just to whip up a sourdough bread or anything like that, as a master chef, I think it'd be phenomenal. Martin Johnson, how can you not?
Yeah.
Alan Wynne-Jones, how can you not? At number four, so Martin Johnson, Alan Wynne-Jones is there. Second rows, number six, really torn on this. Got Chris Robshaw.
Yeah.
And Tom Croft. The reason I mentioned Tom Croft is because if not for injury, he'd go down as one of the best rugby players or best back row players to ever play for England.
Yeah.
And a phenomenal tourist, incredible athlete, wonderful rugby player. Number seven, from a Barbarians perspective, George Smith. Yeah. So, wasn't he player of the year in the Super Rugby for like 10 consecutive seasons or something like that?
I think
like,
so, yeah.
Who does that? Yeah. For the Brumbies, yeah, who does that? So him at number seven, number eight, Nick Easter, man of my own heart, old school, right. Unbelievable on a booze up. He's always been like a social sec judge in charge of the end of season, like montage. And I'm not talking like narrated by David Attenborough, like the biggest mick taker out of all of us. So he's there, but I also put in brackets Andy Powell as well, because how could you not? And I've got a great story in him, but there we go. So yes, that's my pack. Any questions on the pack?
No questions whatsoever.
No questions. Can't argue with that, Hugo.
No.
Okay, decent pack. We were talking earlier, Chris, about being unbiased and how tough that is in commentary. Well, I've got Danny Kerr at number nine. So there we go. At number 10, Andrew Mertens.
Ooh, cool.
Like a wizard, yeah. A magician, and an old school character who's a brilliant tourist. So I've got him. At 11, I've got Joe Rocofoco. But I've made an exception for two other guys who are both in brackets just because I had to make, I just had to. Give them honourable mentions. Sivivati was the best wing ever played against. And Rupeni Thalfa-Inabutha was the best winger on natural talent that ever played the game. But Rocofoco is in it because the strict guidelines of players that I've played with. At 12, Mike Tindall, because if we were ever in like real trouble, he could just ring his grandmother-in-law, our queen, and just like bail us out. So, got to have Tins in there. Brian O'Driscoll.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mercurial talent, one of the best 13s to ever play the game. At 14, got Christian Wade.
Yeah.
Slash Martin Afire. I was trying to nick. I know he played like Union for like one season or two seasons at Wasps, but he's probably one of the best finishers in either code. And we always get confused all the time. Whenever he's at Twickenham and people ask him if he's Hugo, whenever I'm up north, I get asked, are you Martin Afire? So I had to say him. And at 15, Mike Brown, the fiercest competitor and the angriest man. And whether you're a human being or an alien, he's having you. So that's my 15. What do you make of that?
I love it. Absolutely love it. Absolutely love
it. O'Driscoll gets in everyone's.
He's got to be.
He's got to be, yeah.
I watched the 09 series, and as much as we had structures and plans and plays and this and that, it effectively, at points, it was just give him the ball, just let him do something. Yeah. And he's the hardest person, I think, from a coaching perspective. So parents or kids will watch videos, but like, how did he do that? And I'm like, I don't know. I genuinely don't know. And if I was to ask him, he would say it was just instinct. So he's one of those guys it's hard to extract that information from, because when you ask him, he's like, I just saw a gap and I just sidestepped five people and scored a try. You're like, okay, cool. Put that in the coaching manual, please.
He did an awful lot of that with the weight of captaincy as well, which didn't seem to weigh heavy on him at all.
People forget he was captain of Ireland 87 times.
Yeah, unbelievable.
Which is just remarkable to play, is it 137 test matches, I think it was? He's a proper warrior, but, you know, we could talk about his creativity and his mercurial ability, but, like, he had such a big heart, like, genuine, never say die attitude. It was undoing of him in the second test when he got knocked out, banged Danny Rousseau, should have come off the pitch.
Yes.
Should have been off the pitch at that point. Never wanted to leave the field. He fought way above his weight, like a proper hero, a proper champion, proper warrior.
Who's your captain of that team,
Hugo? Ooh, my gosh. Wow. Well, Tins has got a hotline to the Queen. I'd want to give it to him. And he's a great lad for a social, but I don't know. I think I need someone fairly unassuming. I mean, I could easily give it to Mark Johnson, but could I give it to George Smith?
George Smith, nobody would argue with that.
No. You wouldn't argue with many of them, in fairness. I'll give it to George Smith.
George Smith.
I did pick a bench, but I did pick support staff. So my coach, for two reasons. Well, I've got two guys there. One is Michael Jordan. One, because he's got history of aliens, as we've seen in Space Jam. Like, he knows how to defeat them. He's done it once, he could do it again, and he's the GOAT. But then I thought, with this team, loads of egos, you just need someone who's just happy just to get on and do their job. So I thought Steve Kerr, his teammate, who is a legend, but I'm going to Jordan because it's Michael Jordan. He's coach. Waterboy's Will Smith, to continue the aliens theme, Independence Day.
Yes.
Once again, he's been there and done it. But also his triple threat as entertainer. He's an actor, he's a singer, and he's, what was the other thing? And he's comedian, sorry. So triple threat, I think he offers a huge amount as Waterboy. He's got experience, he's got intellect of how to defeat the aliens. Team manager, Bear Grylls. Sorry. You know me. You know, he's taken some of the most famous men to remote places and they've survived. And if he can be trusted with Barack Obama up a hill and with zip wires, he can take lead of this team. So Bear Grylls is team manager. And the kit man, the only caveat, or I guess the only thing that I need to bear in mind is that the kit man, as much as they are the lifeblood of the team, this kit man isn't. I'd like to think of every team member I've selected, whether it's backroom staff or playing staff, that they are all on the same level playing field, that they're very much needed and can provide a huge amount of entertainment, intellect, rugby value, and just be a good bloke. This kit man is none of those. And my theory was is that we'd go to space and we'd just lose him because Earth could actually do with a lot less people like him. So with that, it's Donald Trump. I would love to see him pick up my pants, sweaty socks, sort our kit out, us go to Mars, and just leave him there. The world doesn't need one Donald Trump. And some of the things he said, or lots of things he says and tweets, are just utterly vile. But in a weird way, he is inspiration that to many people, I think, around the world, is that you don't have to be all that intelligent, all that well, I guess, yeah, you don't have to be that intelligent or actually know what you're doing to reach the very top. So if people want to take inspiration from that, fair enough. But yeah, Donald Trump could be our kit man and we can order him about and he can do all our dirty work.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
I'd love to see Will Smith, Martin Johnson and Donald Trump having a chat. Right, some combination, Hugo. I'm not going to lie. Great team, Hugo. And I mean, we've chatted for so long and it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the Loose Heads podcast, Hugo, to reflect on your career, but obviously talk about your involvement with Loose Heads. And I know the guys are so, so proud to have you as an ambassador. So thanks very much for your time.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me. And the only reason I wanted to be a part of Loose Heads is not because of what I can bring or offer, is because of the foundation you've set up. And I mean that in metaphorically as well as the reality of it. You know, I think people and the ambassadors which you've got aligned with it, the impact you have, all that work was done long before I got involved, Sean Edwards, Gareth Anscombe, or any of the other ambassadors or some of the people that come on the on Instagram or social media or on your podcast. So the work which you've done, the foresight you had to see an area which really need targeting, reaching out and speaking about is unbelievable. So thank you guys for setting it up, for impacting loads. And I'm honoured to be a part of it.
Brilliant,
Hugo. Thank you.
Well, we'll let Hugo get off and get a well-deserved gin and tonic. Ron, Mark yes. and Dave, thank you as always. Dave, anything you want to add in terms of admin or stuff this week?
Cheers, Chris. Just get yourselves over to looseheads.co.uk and get yourselves 10% off with code POD at checkout.
Perfect. Well, many thanks to Hugo again. We're all off to get a nice alcoholic beverage. Enjoy your Friday. Thanks very much for listening. And this has been another Loose Heads podcast in association with Talking Rugby Union.